Welcome to Physics and Religion, a series of podcasts exploring the significance of modern science to contemporary religion. I am your host, Dr. Albert Stets. We have just begun our investigation of the phenomenon of human consciousness. The first modern philosopher to think seriously about the mind-body problem was the 17th century Frenchman René Descartes. He is called the father of modern philosophy. Much of subsequent Western philosophy is a response to his writing. He was also a mathematician and a scientist. His contributions to mathematics are quite remarkable. He is responsible, of course, for the Cartesian coordinate system. He is credited as the father of analytic geometry. He also seems to be the first person to develop the idea of symbolic logic. He had a profound influence on Newton. For one thing, he introduced the idea of independent variables, which are essential in calculus. In fact, Descartes was such a remarkable person that it is fun to tell stories about him. For example, on the night of November 10th, 1619, Descartes locked himself in a room with a heater to escape the chill. While in the room, he had three visions. Upon emerging the next morning, he had, among other things, invented analytic geometry. The best story of all, however, concerns his daughter. Descartes never married, but he had a daughter out of wedlock named Francine. He apparently had great affection for her. He is reported to have said that her death from scarlet fever was the greatest sorrow of his life. In order to appreciate this story, you also need to know that Descartes was fascinated by automatons. In other words, mechanical figures run by clockwork that looked human and could mimic some human behavior. Today we would probably call them robots. Late in his life, Descartes traveled to Sweden to act as a tutor to Queen Christina. Crossing the North Sea in a sailing vessel was hazardous in the extreme, and during the trip, the ship was buffeted by high winds. Descartes had told other passengers that he was traveling with Francine, but no one had seen her. Some sailors took advantage of the general alarm to sneak into Descartes' room to see what they could make of his daughter. They saw nothing but a large wooden box. Upon opening the box, the figure of a young woman stood up and walked towards them. The superstitious sailors assumed that this was the work of witchcraft and cast the figure overboard. Of course, not all this story can be documented. Incidentally, Descartes was possibly assassinated and is now interred in the Abbey of Saint-Germain-des-Prés in Paris, but his skull and one finger are missing. There's a long story here, which I don't have time to tell you. There's been an entire book written on the subject. See Descartes' Bones, A Skeletal History of the Conflict Between Faith and Reason by Russell Shorto. Descartes held that there were two kinds of, well, what he called substance, mind and body. For obvious reasons, this point of view is called dualism. The mind could exist outside the body and had no physical properties, such as mass and location. It can think, the body cannot. The mind can control the body, but the body can also control the mind, as, for example, when one does something out of passion. The two interact through the pineal gland, which, he suggested, is the seat of the soul. Man is born with inherent knowledge that comes from a higher power. Now, leaving aside the pineal gland, after all, we know a lot more about physiology than Descartes did. This seems like just common sense. Our consciousness does seem separate from our body. If you didn't know that thinking goes on inside your head, you could just as well believe that consciousness was located in your spleen or liver. Put another way, consciousness just doesn't seem to have any definite physical location. On the other hand, if you have ever done something out of passion that you later regretted, you might feel that your body, not your rational mind, made you do it. Dualism also interfaces easily with Christianity. Mind is not only the seat of consciousness, it is also the seat of the soul. God and the other heavenly powers are of the same substance as mind, and so, for example, silent prayer makes perfect sense. Dualism also solves a problem that we will grapple with at the end of this series, namely the possibility of free will. We can think and decide things in our minds safely beyond the reach of any sort of physical determinism. For all its advantages, dualism famously suffers from a problem that the pineal gland doesn't really fix. Namely, how do mind and body interact? The philosopher Colin McGinn has summed it up nicely. There's the zombie problem and the ghost problem. The zombie problem is that we can coherently imagine subtracting your mind from your body. What is left looks exactly like you. It walks and talks and in all other ways seems like a real human being, but it has no consciousness. You can talk to it and it will reply, but there is no one home. It will not look like the zombies you may have seen in the movies. This is a real top-shelf zombie. It looks like a human being, but it's not human. Even if we don't go all the way imagining away the mind substance, we could still imagine that the consciousness exists, but it doesn't have any effect on the body. It is sort of an accidental and useless appendage. This is a school of philosophy called epiphenomenalism. There is an oft-quoted metaphor to make this clear. Think of a rainbow over a waterfall. The rainbow arises from the waterfall, but it has no effect on the waterfall. It is in no way necessary for the waterfall to fall. So it is with consciousness. It's just floating out there. This leads to the problem of qualia. We will meet this term again. It is really the central issue in understanding consciousness. Suppose I see something red. I say, I am seeing red. The natural assumption is that I said that because I am having the experience of seeing red. But my zombie lookalike says, I am seeing red, and he has no experience at all. In his case, some red photoreceptors pick up some photons and relay the signal to the lateral geniculate cortex. From there it goes to the primary visual cortex, and after considerable processing, something is sent to his speech centers, whereupon his mouth and vocal cords move in such a way as to make the sounds, I am seeing red, come out of his mouth. He is, in fact, an automaton running on very sophisticated neurological clockwork. If that explanation is sufficient to explain his behavior, why should my behavior be any different? This seems wrong. We would like to believe that our conscious thought influences our behavior, but dualism seems to imply that it has no effect whatsoever. The ghost problem is the converse of the zombie problem. If the body can be detached from the mind, then the mind can be detached from the body. So disembodied minds become a real possibility. This is fraught with problems. Where did your mind come from in the first place? Where is it now? How does it interact with other minds? Can it move through walls? Does it? The ghosts in horror stories can interact with the physical world, or else we would not have much of a story. Our disembodied minds can't. For all these reasons, dualism has become a bad word in philosophy. No one wants to be called a dualist. If you want to insult a philosopher, you might borrow a line from Shakespeare and call him, say, an elvish, marked, abortive, rooting hog. But if you really want to insult him, call him a Cartesian dualist. The other main option is monism. This comes in many different varieties, but the basic idea is that there is no consciousness apart from the brain. Mind and brain are just one thing. I am going to argue, in the course of these talks, that monism of whatever variety is also logically untenable. Eventually, I will get around to telling you how I think one should resolve the dilemma. Before we get to that, we must acknowledge that Descartes has left us with two problems that we should deal with immediately. The first has to do with vision. We know that the lens of the eye focuses an image on the retina. But then what? How is it that I know what I'm looking at? Descartes implies that the image is then projected on a kind of screen inside the brain. Then someone or something must be looking at it. The philosopher Daniel Dennett has called this the Cartesian theater. I'm sure that you have spotted the problem. There must be a little man in your brain, a homunculus, but how does he see? I will spend the next lecture on this problem. The answer is, not to put too fine a point on it, that the image is projected on some 20 different screens, and we still don't know who is watching. The second problem gets back to the matter of automatons. Descartes' dualism was inspired by his love of automata. The body, to his way of thinking, was, like our zombie look-alike, a kind of machine. That is still a viable position, though today we would put it differently. We would say that the brain is a kind of computer. The neurons constitute the hardware, our thoughts are the calculation, our memory is like a hard drive, and the whole thing runs on a kind of operating system. We might go so far as to say that we, in principle, could build a computer that was conscious in the same way we are. A subsequent podcast will deal with that possibility.